Before we begin this episode, I want to give a huge shout out to all of our patrons over on patreon.com/bitterbrownfems. If you want to help support this podcast, do feel free to support us on Patreon. You can find the link in the description of this episode. I do want to take a moment to give a very special warm thank you to all of our BBF, BFF level patrons, including Anna H., Cassandra G., Christian G., Cynthia P., Delia, Elizabeth O., Evelyn, Guadalupe F., Catelyn, Marisol, Laura R., and Nini. Y'all mean the world to us. All right, let's start the show.
We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. Fucking thing sucks.
Hello, hello, hello. This is your host, Ruben, coming to you from LA.
Hello, and this is your other host, Cassandra, coming to you from El Paso, Texas.
Hey.
Hey, hey.
Shout out, El Chuco. Shout out
915, baby.
Hey.
El Chuco Town.
How's El Paso treating you lately, Cassandra?
Good. It's, you know, what's that thing called that people care about? Climate change is
climate
real.
Climate change. Is it?
Climate change, yeah. Yeah, she's ruining my vibe. Yeah, it's like for spring, we usually have like 2 weeks of disgusting winds with dirt and it's like gross. And then it immediately goes to like just warm weather. And this year it's like the wind, it will not go away. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, it's like, I hate it. I hate the wind so fucking much. But, and then it was like, I don't know. And then it went cold again for a hot minute. It was just, and then it rained. It was just it's like all over the place. But I think it's finally just going to be warm now, thankfully. And just be fucking hot now. But yeah.
When is the rainy season over there?
So it's in July. And it's actually like my favorite time of the year. And we didn't have it last year.
Shut up.
Thanks to climate change.
So it just, really just did not rain?
No. Like usually the month of July is just like thunderstorms. And it's like that's our season. But it didn't happen. I mean, it rained throughout the year. But that, you know, not like in July like it usually happens. So I'm hoping that it comes back this year, but yeah, I don't know. That was kind of sad, actually. How's the weather over there?
It's good. It's just getting hot. I am afraid that we're also not going to have a rainy season. Last year we did, but it was like the first real rainy season of like a long drought. Mm-hmm. California is constantly like in danger of like being like severely in drought. Particularly SoCal, because we have to import our water, actually. Because, much of SoCal is a desert. Like, LA is literally a desert. They just built a whole fucking city here. So, I'm like you. I'm also a desert person.
Are you? I heard, Caitlyn Jenner is running.
Oh, girl. We're gonna have our first... Representation matters. We're gonna have our first trans Republican governor
who's just like
she would be the third from Hollywood though to be our governor. There was Ronald Reagan, and then there was Arnold Schwarzenegger, and now it's gonna be her.
That is so sad. Do you think that
there's no way she's winning?
No. Okay, because she put out like an ad and I watched it, don't ask why, because I was like, just, you know.
Yeah.
And people were retweeting it like, this is so amazing, and I was okay.
Oh, but, God.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hope
she's a hot mess. Like, I'm like, I just...
Girl, she killed somebody.
People Remember wanted that? To root for you. And, like,
Yeah, people are...
Yeah.
I think we all gave her the benefit of the doubt when she first, you know, came into the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like, support.
Yeah.
And it's like...
And then we all saw it getting bad, but then when Trump became president and she was like a Trump supporter, then it was like, okay, deuces, bitch. You know?
Yeah. I'm like, they don't even like you, girl. Like, what is going on?
But there was never a photo. Yeah.
She's, you know, she doesn't have to worry about, you know, everything else because she's rich at the end of the day. Like, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't faze her. But yeah. Are you fully vaccinated?
Fully vaxxed, girl. Ready to mingle, ready to party, girl.
Fully vaxxed, waxed, ready to party.
I just found a sugar waxing place, so you know what? Maybe I will get waxed once again. I haven't gotten waxed in like a solid 3 years.
Me too, actually. I feel like I haven't, like, maybe 2 years. Maybe we should do that as a little treat.
Girl, Patreon only exclusive. Down and dirty.
Exactly.
It's because when I lived in... I first I moved to, you know, one of my hometowns of Bell, and like there is like no, well, first of all, it's like a food desert, and second of all, it's like a desert of like those type of businesses, and so I couldn't just like go get wax. Whereas when I lived in Oakland, it was like, it's a real, like, a dense city, so there's a bunch of businesses everywhere, so I could literally walk to go get wax and then just walk back home. Yeah. Okay. Because I don't have a car, so I needed to walk.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah. But now I found one with walking distance, so girl, I'm gonna be real shiny.
Yeah, I'm fully waxed too. I feel like I've asked you already, but
you said fully waxed too.
Well, both. I mean, I did get
work.
No, just kidding. No, I did get my eyebrows waxed though. It's a little wax.
It's a little something.
It's a little something. It's like the question everyone asks, like, which vaccine did you get? I don't know if I asked you already.
You know, she's a Pfizer girl, but...
Oh, me too. I guess this is a Pfizer podcast then.
Yeah. I'm glad that, like, you know what? The one good thing, well, I'm sure he's done other things, but one of the notable things that Biden did recently, we'll give him credit, was, like, fight back against like the corporations, particularly like Bill Gates' shit about who are like defending the patent, right? Who didn't want to disperse the patent for the vaccine. And so Biden made it so that they don't have intellectual property rights to the vaccine. Hasn't been fully, you know, gone into order, but it might, and that would mean like a great deal for like a lot of countries who are really suffering with COVID still in ways that have lessened in other places, but in India and I believe in Brazil as well, you know, the disease is still ravaging people.
Yeah, and that's obviously just another reminder that this shit is not over, not even here. Mm-mm. Like, you know, yes, like, we're lucky to have, you know, that we have the vaccine, that people are getting vaccinated, but that doesn't mean that it's like we're in the clear and everything's back to normal and we're just gonna act, you know, irresponsible and not care. We still encourage people to wear their masks. I know the CDC or whatever was like, you don't have to wear a mask anymore if you're outside, God. Or I don't know what that was. I don't know.
Girl, yeah, they're just trying to make it, because at the end of the day, we have to know that like the CDC still has like capitalist ties and like liberal ties. So like it was trying to like lessen the worries about kids going back to school, essentially. Because it also said, like, you only have to stand 3 feet away from somebody. And it's like, what?
Did it say that?
There was one thing out. At least in California, there was, like, a thing out where, like, you can now stand 3 feet next to each other.
Absolutely not.
No, girl, the mask is staying on forever. You are not seeing these lips without paying a little something. Like, unless... yeah. No.
Yeah. No, for sure. So it's like, still take precautions, still understand that even in it here, but especially thinking of people in other countries, you know, and like what they're like, they don't have vaccines. Like, they're still going through this shit that we were going through, you know?
Shit. So, people in this country too, like, you know, everybody has had access to it yet.
Not everyone has had access. People can still get it. People, yeah. are still in the hospital. Like, people are still dying. It's still very real.
Yeah, so in case you didn't know, you know, as a, in regards to the vaccine, originally, you know, corporations, you know, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, like, those corporations, like, owned the vaccine. So other countries, other medical establishments, they couldn't replicate it without having to pay a shit ton to these corporations. And so because of that, that kept the vaccine away from a lot of people that really needed it, a lot of countries, entire countries that needed it. And so Biden putting, like, a stop on, like, their intellectual property rights, citing the fucking pandemic, right? Public safety. That's, like, a major move. And so let's hope that that goes through well. Because ultimately, if one person has the virus, like, we all are in danger, essentially. So it is in everyone's best interest that everyone in the world has access to the vaccine, right? So, yeah, that's that. I think what we wanted to talk today was, like, the outcome of the Derek Chauvin case, him being the murderer of George Floyd. You know, he was found guilty and sentenced to prison time. And, you know, a lot of folks were praising the verdict, including, you know, a lot of politicians. And people were saying that, you know, George Floyd's murder being sentenced to prison was accountability. And today we're kind of trying to talk to, about why, like, maybe that wasn't the right use of words, right? First of all, the system was not holding itself accountable. It was using this murder as a sacrifice to convince people that the justice system works every now and then, right? Well, when we should know by now that that's not the case. The justice system rarely works for marginalized people, right? But because this case had gotten so big and had, you know, sparked such a movement in the last year, such conversations, it was, you know, the trial, the jury found it necessary to convict, right? At the end of the day, you can't hold systems of oppression accountable, because accountability means that these systems would have to have community ties, community, and be committed to growth. And that's just not possible for a violent system. A violent system is not here to make community. A violent system is here to oppress community. And actually, it is here to divide community, right? It is here to support individualism and make it seem like systemic problems are actually individual ones, right? So I know a lot of folks use the word accountability because it is a word that has maybe entered the popular lexicon in the last few years, particularly as abolition gains traction. But I want us to, you know, rein it back a little bit and consider that accountability means a commitment to other people, and systems can never have that commitment.
Yeah, I kept seeing a lot of people, you know, saying this is not justice, this is accountability, and obviously, you know, intentions were good, that it wasn't justice, at least we were clear on that. But yeah, on the accountability, you're right, I think within, also I think within the Me Too movement, accountability has been also one of those words that people are bringing up, right? Like, but also it, because of abolition as well, and just, I think we need to keep in mind when we're talking about accountability that it is like, what, when is it accountability and who are we talking about? So it's, you know, I don't know. I keep seeing, I think we talked about this back during the Capitol thing that happened. I don't even know what we were calling that. About how, you know, people are always like, if Black people did this, you know, then this would happen. And I think we see that a lot too during whenever, like, we're talking about police brutality and police shootings, and we're like, you know, this white person got away with this, and this white person got away, was arrested without being killed, and we're still kind of doing that thing where we're still somehow centering white people, if that makes sense, in this discourse of what was going on. Like, we're still comparing it when it's like the police shouldn't be killing anyone, period. Like, that should just be the sentence, right? Like, police shouldn't kill anyone. It doesn't matter if they're white, doesn't matter, like, really, you know, doesn't matter white, doesn't matter black, doesn't matter what they are doing, doesn't matter if they are guilty, even, does not matter if they have a weapon, doesn't matter if they're running away, like, it just, you know, I shared this TikTok about, like, the perfect victim, right, and how we fall into that trap of, like, making it, you know, like, they are a good person, and they had their hands up, and they were surrendering, and they weren't doing this, and it's like, okay, but it doesn't matter, you know, at the end of the day. Like, I saw people doing that with, like, Adam Toledo, who's, a 13-year-old boy who was killed in Chicago a few weeks ago. And it's, like, people were, like, he had his hands up. And I'm, like, does it really fucking matter? This was a child, first of all. But it's, like, it doesn't matter if he's a child. It doesn't matter if he, like, none of that matters. Like, I think that when we're having conversations about police shootings and police violence, it's, like, period. Like, people, like, they shouldn't do this to anybody, period, you know? Because it just keeps us, you know, going around in these circles and kind of still upholding, like, the system, right? Like, we're just kind of like we're doing with, like, the trial and the accountability and, like, kind of praising this system for, like, putting this man away and, like, sentencing him. And it, like, it's like this cycle, right? Because now we're like, oh, the system works. Oh, finally, like, the system did what it had to do. And it's like, did it though? Because it's like, now we're like, the system works. So now, from now on, they're going to convict these cops, and we're going to put our faith back into the system. And it's just like, that's like intentional, right? It's like, okay, well, we saw all of these protests and all of these uprisings, and so, yeah, okay, I guess this time we have to sacrifice this person so that people can believe in the system again, and everything can just, you know, calm down and go back to normal until it happens again and again and again and again. So that's just like some things to keep in mind when we're having these conversations. And I also just wanted to point out, you know, as a non-black person, that I am not ever going to have any opinion or comment on how black people react to these police shootings, how they react to these trials, how they react to any of this, because I'm not black, you know? I don't have any say in that. I will never understand that. What I share, and I think what we're talking about is also specifically for non-black people, right? And when we're saying, like, to take these things into account and how to talk about these things, because we are non-black people. Our job is to dismantle anti-blackness. It's our job to speak up on these things, because even though police violence does affect, you know, everybody, like I just mentioned, children, Latinx folks, Asian people, disabled people, like, even though it affects everybody, we know that that police itself is rooted in anti-blackness because of its history. We know that black people are targeted more, right? So it is a conversation about, like, how do we show up for black folks, right? Yeah, I just wanted to point that out, because I don't want to be like, oh, like, if you're a black person, you shouldn't ever, you know, like, that's not my place. This is mostly for non-black folks, because it's also, when I'm talking about these cycles of, like, putting our faith back into the system, I think that we are the main ones that fall into that, because we're like, oh, okay, I guess, you know, we don't have to put the Black Lives Matter, you know, Instagram posts anymore. I can take it out of my bio. No, not that that shit was doing anything to begin with, but you know what I mean? We're like, oh, we can relax now. We can, like, not have to be, like, what's that thing called? Ally fatigue, you know? Like, this is aimed at non-black people. Like, it is not time to relax. It is not a time to, you know, be like, oh, okay, good, you know? No, this is a time to continue, you know, pushing for abolition, continue, like, organizing, continue reading, continue, like, the things that we should be doing, not to be complacent. And, yep, that's my two cents on that.
Because I saw, you know, certain politicians trying to spin this verdict into a sense of complacency, right? With Nancy Pelosi thanking George Floyd for, quote-unquote, his sacrifice. right? And essentially what she meant is that even in her words, she tried to thank him for, in the best read of her saying that, it was her thanking him for, you know, allowing justice to be served for once, a justice system to function for once, right? But it shouldn't require anyone's death for a system that's supposed to be benevolent to work properly, right? And so here's where we have to look past the veneer they're presenting us and understand that these systems are never going to work for us, right? So placing our trust in them is only ever going to work in favor of those in power, right? Those with capital, those with political ties. Yeah, because, you know, as she was saying that, you know, as Nancy Pelosi was thanking George Floyd for the sacrifice and George Floyd for his sacrifice and people putting their trust in the system all of a sudden, like, you know, in another state, Makia Bryant was being murdered by police, right? A teenage girl. And not just a teenage black girl, but also someone who was in the foster care system, right? So someone who is under multiple, the where someone who was, who experienced violence from multiple systems, right? So we have to understand that the only way forward is abolition, right? And with Makia Bryant, we really have to start questioning. For a lot of people, for a lot of us, I know me included, I immediately started thinking about, you know, what if there was a social worker who was, you know, would have been called to split up the family, the foster family argument. And I think that this moment is also asking us to look beyond that type of mentality even, because recently Cassandra and I spoke about this, and Cassandra had mentioned to me how, what was the last essentially benevolent social worker, you know, how would they have been any different than a police person, right? And I really had to sit back and think about, like, yeah, you know, I had a family who was system impacted, who did have to deal with social work, and they were not the best people, right? Especially in an in abusive environments.
Yeah, and I think we've been seeing these conversations about, you know, when we're talking about defund the police and abolish, like last year I saw a lot of like social workers are going to do this work, counselors are going to do this work. And I think that within abolition, you know, we do all have to reimagine a better world. We have to reimagine like what are we creating instead of these things, right? Because it's not just about destroying prisons and borders, and it's like, what are we creating, right? It's not just like, let's destroy everything. Like, what is that going to do? You know, we have to think beyond these things. And so, you know, I think people were getting, you know, I think that it's important that people just have these conversations. And like, it is like, I'm not saying like, if this was your first train of thought, like, you know, you're like ridiculous for thinking that. No, like, I think that is what, when we have these conversations about abolition and like a better world, like everyone kind of, like I said, has to be imagine that, but we also have to think, okay, what are the problems with, for example, social workers now? And a lot of social workers, and not just social workers, like teachers, counselors, like they also are, obviously they're not like armed like the police force, and their jobs are not the same, obviously, but they are still capable of being violent with children, with clients, with other people. Like, they're still people who hold racist values. Like, just because you're a social worker, just because you're a teacher, just because you're a nurse even, right? Like, that doesn't automatically make you this like good person that's not capable of these things. And not, you know, and they're like, these jobs, even though again they're not comparable necessarily to the police force, who has like a lot of power, they still do have power, right? And like certain ways in certain areas. And so I think also need to look at, like, for example, I'll try to find some of these articles, but I know that I saw a lot of indigenous people sharing like why expecting social workers to fill in these roles is wrong, especially because, for example, social workers have specifically when talking about children, have removed Indigenous children from Indigenous communities and Indigenous families since, you know, fucking forever. And so they are like, they're not someone that has been, you know, like the savior, or not necessarily even a savior, but just like a good person to turn to, right? They've caused a lot of trauma for a lot of people. And again, that's not to say all the social workers in the world are the worst and they're worthless. Obviously not. But it's just like, we have to just think critically about what it means. Like, and also just like the concept of policing, which I think we all, me and Ruben also talked about, like when we're saying like, we're gonna replace the police with like people who are going to police other people. Like, there's still a even though it's not the cops, even though it's not the same institution, it's still like people policing people. And what does that mean? What does policing other people look like? Why do we want to replicate that and just say it's like a nicer version because they're social workers and they don't have guns, but they're still going around, in a sense, trying to judge people, or, you know what I mean? Like, there's still like this negative connotation there of like policing, like you're policing people, when we should just be supporting people. And again, like, I'm new to abolition. I don't have all the answers, and there's people who have been doing this work who we should, you know, learn from, read like their work and engage with it. But again, like, I know that just we need to think outside of these things. And it's hard because, I mean, this is all kind of a lot of us have known, right? And it's sometimes it does feel impossible to think, like, what can we do instead of this? How do we do this, right? It is kind of difficult. And especially, again, like, there's so many factors, right? Like, capitalism, I feel like, destroys our imagination and creativity. And it, like, there's just a lot, but that's why I think it's important to have like these ongoing conversations, right? And always like listen to and read and engage with works of like the most marginalized people, because they're the ones who are like we should take lead from. I'm sorry, I don't even know how I ended up here. I think we're talking about social workers, yes. Yeah. And also, speaking of like Micaiah Bryant, she was in foster care, and therefore, she was in the hands, is that, in the care of the state? The ward of the state, right? And she tragically, and I mean, tragically, I don't even know, like, just, she got killed by the state. Like, it's just so fucking ugly. Like, that day that happened, like, literally, like, 2 hours, an hour after, like, the verdict, was just like, why are we praising this system again, right? Like, why are we, it was just like this terrible like reminder. And I don't want to call her like murder reminder, it feels wrong to do so. So I don't know, you know, I just, it just really like impacted me, because she is like a young girl, she was a young Black girl who was having trouble at the home. There was like an article that came out, actually, like, that I don't know when it came out, but I read it like 2 days ago, and it was like, this family who she had been staying with for over a year, her and her sister, and there had been multiple calls to the police from her sister, from her, from the foster mom, from other foster kids that were there that ran away. And obviously, we don't know all the details, but there obviously were some issues there. And I'm not, you know, trying to insinuate that the foster parents were these terrible people. I mean, they could be, and maybe they weren't. But it's like, the foster care system is so corrupt, and it's not like the, you know, it's just like a shitty system. It's like, do these foster parents have the resources for this? Or are we just sticking these children, you know, with whoever? A lot of these foster parents also, I'm not saying all, obviously, but a lot of them also abuse children. A lot of them also like taking children for money. A lot of them probably have multiple foster kids in their home, and they just probably don't know. Like I said, like, they don't have support, they don't have resources. A lot of these kids are getting pulled out of their parents' house for reasons that could be fixed, right? Like, for a lot of like Black families and Indigenous families, poor families, like they get their kids taken away due to poverty. Instead of saying like, how do we help this family feed their kids? How do we help them move into a home, get them out of this shelter? How do we keep families together? Like, the state literally just takes these children away and puts them into foster homes where they experience more trauma, where they don't experience, where they don't, some, most majority of the time, don't get stability. They're moving around from schools, and then we're, you know, and then we factor in like the foster care to prison pipeline on top of like the school to prison pipeline. Like, there is just so much trauma for these kids, a lot of these kids, and then the state pushes them out when they're 18, and it's like, where are they supposed to go? You know, a lot of them end up on the streets. Like, it's just like this terrible, very terrible also system that we have going, and it's just like, her story is just so, it just really impacted me. And also the fact that a lot of people were justifying her murder, and I think that also has a lot obviously to deal with the fact that she's a Black girl. Just like Black women usually don't get a lot of media attention as much as like Black men when it comes to police shootings. And also, you know, someone had also pointed out it's the fact that she was fat. And I know that might seem like, oh, like dramatic or like not real to people, but people were sharing like some of the things that people were saying about her. And it's like, because she was a big girl, they were like, oh, that plus like Black children and Black teens not being seen as teens or children. Like, there was just a lot like going on. And like the fact that people went from, you know, like George Floyd, oh, you know, good, this person's going to jail, to immediately like justifying, literally like a few hours later, just justifying the fact that this Black girl got killed by police, was just like, is this like happening right now in real time? And it goes back to that, just that the fact that people were like, oh, she had a knife, right? And it's like, it goes back to that thing I was talking about earlier, when we say, oh, this person didn't have a weapon, oh, this person was surrendering, oh, this person was a straight A student, for example, I don't know, like, what, we are creating perfect victims. If we all like just were like taking a stand and saying the police shouldn't fucking kill anybody, period, then we wouldn't have people saying that shit like, oh, she had a knife, because it wouldn't matter. Like, you're telling me that this cop couldn't like go in there himself and get stabbed? I'm sorry, I don't give a shit. Like, that's your fucking quote-unquote job. Like, you would rather shoot down a teen girl than like going in there yourself, like, and like, it just, yeah. But there's just a lot to unpack there with, again, like everything, the foster care system, which also, you know, obviously tied into like what we're talking about, like social workers, because I don't know if like the CPS, the people who work for CPS, are technically social workers, right? Or they're not.
I think they are, like, in, at least in that.
They're kind of in that same. Yeah. And we know that like CPS is also something that needs to be abolished on top of the foster care system, because a lot of CPS, with all these jobs that I'm mentioning, it's also like, we're living under capitalism. They're overworked. They're underpaid. They probably went in thinking like, I'm going to do this good thing, and they can't, you know, it's like this unrealistic, there's no support. Like, the whole systems, all of these systems are just like violent. And all they do really is just like produce trauma and trauma and trauma. Like, there's like nothing good that's coming out of these things, as much as we'd like for their, you know, a lot of us are like, CPS, they go in and they take this kid out of abuse homes, and that's not the reality of that, you know. So I think we just need to take a look at these institutions, at these systems, and like really think, are they actually doing like what we think they're doing? Just like how we think and talk about prisons, right? And like, no, they're not really doing much. Like I said, they're just kind of creating more trauma. And a lot of these jobs are like really like emphasized on children. So it's just, yeah.
I remember last time, you know, we talked about this. You have brought up to me how, you know, capitalism plays into this, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember telling you how it made sense to me, you know, how when we think about foster care, we think about like, oh, you know, these kids are in this care because their parents couldn't take care of them or their parents were harmful to them. And I remember thinking about like how capitalism makes it difficult for parents to care for their kids, right? Because it changes mm-hmm. the relationship from a parent caring for a child. It changes from that to a parent having to provide for a child. So
yeah, we start, it's like instead of seeing your child as your child, they're like a financial burden, yeah, essentially.
So
under capitalism. Know,
yeah, you stop seeing them as like, oh, this kid that I love, as opposed, you know, you stop seeing them as this kid that I love and you start seeing them as this kid that I need to pay, you know, rent for and light bills for and backpacks for, and I have to take care of their school, and they become a stressor. And so how do we alleviate that to avoid whatever mental strife can come with that and whatever harm that might lead someone to enact, right? Not to say to excuse any harmful behavior, but to try to make sense of it, right? And try to get to the bottom of it from an anti-capitalist perspective, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think you know, I think when we're talking about child abuse, for example, or just negligence, I think it's never an excuse, but we do need to, like, just like when we're talking about abolition, we're getting to the root of why do people abuse children. And there's a lot that goes into that, that we've talked about, you know, how we view children, how we ourselves were raised and thinking that it's okay to do that. But one of them, when we're talking specifically about capitalism, is that we start seeing our children as, we also see them as not as these whole people. Like I said, we see them as financial burdens, as things that trigger us under capitalism, which is stress, especially financially. And then a lot of us don't have, and I'm saying a lot of us as speaking as a parent, like, don't have support on how to parent in nonviolent ways. You know, there's just, it's just a lack of support, especially, yeah, I don't know, capitalism devalues children. It, like, when was it? Like, last week, or a few days ago, actually, it was, like, that Biden announced that they were going to do, like, free childcare, and I think it's only, if I'm not mistaken, for, like, 3 to 4 year olds. I'm sorry, y'all, I was going to look up the details on it, but then I started, like, engaging with, like, conservative people on Twitter that were opposed to the idea of, like, free childcare. And it's laughable, first of all, because white people are, like, the inventors of having other people raise their children, and they're, like, all of a sudden outraged at childcare. But anyway, and it's, like, when we're talking about one of, like, this, I don't even know who he is. I was just assuming he's, like, I don't know, he's a conservative politician or what, but they were, like, arguing, like, this whole thread about why it's wrong for free childcare, and they always bring up the, like, people are just gonna drop their kids off at childcare, and they're like, it's, you know, that whole free shit, like freeloaders or whatever. But it's like, parents need to raise their own kids, and it's like, yeah, they do, but why aren't they? Because they're working to survive. They're working 2 jobs sometimes. Your kid is at school, then they go to daycare, then, or they have a babysitter, or your one of your relatives is watching them, and then sometimes kids have to take care of themselves because their parents are working, or their siblings take care of them, right? And you hardly see your children, you're hardly able to engage with them. I know, like, my mom, for example, is a single mom, she always worked. My older sister was the one who, like, pretty much took care of us. Sometimes my abuelita would come, but it was like, my mom was never involved in my school, one, because there's, like, a language barrier, but 2, because she was so exhausted. She didn't have time for that, you know? sometimes, like, we don't see our children for, and then it's different. Like, for example, for me, I've talked about this a lot. I've always had a deal, like, I've always had to get jobs that I was able to work around my child's schedule at school, because a lot of these jobs, like, don't give a shit if you have a child. They're like, oh, okay, like, you can't work this, too bad. You know, I got denied unemployment because I didn't have childcare. Like, I couldn't get a job because I didn't have childcare. So it's, and then it's, sometimes it's like, do I want to pay this much money for a daycare? Like, I'm going to work to pay daycare. I might as well not have a job. And then I don't have a job and I'm like, I get benefits, but like, do I, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like this whole cycle of poverty. There's like no support. So I do think that childcare should be free, obviously, for, if we're talking about like people like having to work. But it's like, at the end of the day, it would be better if we could just have, not have to fucking work to provide for our families, and if we could just like work like 4-3 days a week and still be able to survive and like raise our children. Like, there was like this question people ask on Twitter that's like, if capitalism didn't exist, like, what would be your dream job, or what would you like devote your time doing, you know? And it's like, for me, it was like simple. I was like thinking about it, and I was like, well, I would be able, I feel like, to actually raise my child without being like, oh my God, I don't have a job. Oh my God, I like don't have money to feed my child. Like, and actually raise my child and like spend time with them and teach them and not have to worry about like all this other shit. So capitalism is destroying families as well as the nuclear family, which is something that was like a hot topic today, I guess, like on Twitter. I don't know what started it, but I saw this TikTok that was like, and I think that this TikTok, the person who made it, this Black woman, was talking specifically to a Black community, but I saw people, you know, talking about nuclear families, and it was like, they were saying that it's incorrect to say that the nuclear family is rooted in white supremacy, or that white people invented it. And people were like, they did, kind of. So it was like this conversation, which now I kind of want to read the history of nuclear families, like, as a whole. But anyway, so nuclear families, I, from my understanding, and this is why I want to dig more into it, of its history, is like, from my understanding, it was kind of created post-World War II. And it's kind of like a mom and a dad and their kids and a white picket fence. Like, that is the nuclear family. And the reason, I also think it was like a capitalist invention on top of like this white, I don't know if white supremacy is the right word, but capitalism for sure, was that it takes like this little family, and then you buy a home, and then the other nuclear family buys a home, and it also removes you from community. So now you're kind of like, you know, everyone, like my family and every, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like this individual thing, even though it's a family. Like, you're still only thinking about your family, and that might include, you know, maybe your grandma, like some extended family member, but generally it's just like your family, right? And so like, houses go up on the market, obviously, because now everyone has like their own little unit, right? And when I mentioned that it removes you from community, now all of a sudden everyone's like, you know, that's your family, you take care of your kids, I'll take care of mine, versus like, if nuclear families didn't exist, it would be community. Like, wow, you know, everyone's always like, it takes a village, and it's like, that's literal. Like, I know people like to throw that shit around, but it does. And it reminds me of this quote that I'm going to read real quick. You know me and my quotes, from Carla Bergman, who's like a youth liberation activist, I would call her. But this is like a quote from her that says, if we centered children's rights, capitalism would have to end, and nuclear families would unfold outward into communities. And I think that that's like a perfect for what we're talking about, right? A lot of us, I mean, forget centering children's rights, or children in general. A lot of us don't even include children. A lot of these, like, you know, so-called anti-capitalist people don't even think about how capitalism hurts children and families and parents, and how if we actually like included that, I think so many more people would be like, on board towards abolition, towards community, towards tearing all this shit down, because it does affect children, it does affect families, it does affect parents on like so many levels, right? But yeah, I think nuclear families are also very heteronormative on top of everything else, right? Like, it's like the man and the woman, and it doesn't leave room for trans parents. It doesn't, you don't even need, like, so this conversation I'm talking about was like people talking about, you know, the way that people were framing this conversation was like, nuclear, like, if we're people that are saying destroy the nuclear family are like anti-men, like that whole thing of like we're trying to remove like father figures or some bullshit. And it's like, it's very telling that that's what you think that means, because that just means that you're centering men as like the head of a family, and it's very patriarchal when you don't need a man to be a parent. Do you know what I mean? Like, to like, you like, come on, it's 2021. You don't need like two cis people to create a child. Like, it's just just like centering men in these conversations, like they're trying to destroy the father, and it's like, oh my god, like no one is saying we're destroying like we're trying to get rid of men or fathers, even. We're just saying like the nuclear family, the way that we know it, is like, for what? Like, there are queer families, there are adoptive families, even there are foster families there, and those are all valid, like what we're calling families. But it's more about like community and how like this nuclear family bullshit has like isolated us. And I think it's very also important to note that during the pandemic, especially, like, it should, if you're a parent or a single parent, if you're like, if you have kids, like during this fucking pandemic, you've been even more isolated than before, because parenting itself for me is very lonely and isolating. So just like being in your, like in our own little nuclear families or whatever the fuck, like by ourselves during this pandemic, should tell you that we need community, that we need other people to like support us raising. And it's like, I don't know, I feel like when people say like, I need to help other people raise their children, even though I didn't have them, like they get all like, you know, mad about it. But it's not like, it's just like caring, it's just like supporting people. And I always say this, like, it's like the people that are always like anti-capitalist and are always like community this, community that, but when we're talking about families and we're talking about parents and we're talking about children, all of a sudden they're like, what community? Like, sorry, that's your kid, gotta go, you know. So that's just like something to think about, as always. And sorry I ranted there on like so many things I feel, but yeah, fuck capitalism. I think, yeah, for those who actually care about children, yeah, we gotta destroy capitalism and the nuclear family.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought that the root of the nuclear family was rooted in kind of like feudalism, like where you had to basically have a bunch of children with a, you know, as a heterosexual couple so that you can tend to the fields and shit. But not even like as a cooperative, but as like a lonely person with like your one field type of thing. But yeah, no, I mean, I've been on this. As someone who broke out of the nuclear family really young, like, I've kind of been on that tip for a minute. Yeah, I just don't know. Especially, I feel like in Latinx households, we're raised to devalue, like, community and friendship sometimes. Because we're told, like, you know, family first, because your friends are not going to have your back, right? Like, my family literally would say, like, you know, why are you spending so much time with your friends? Like, you know, you should spend time with your family, because when, you know, shit gets real, your friend's not going to be there for you. And, you know, my life proved that that wasn't the case, right? That my friends really shut up for me. But yeah, no, I mean, that's how capitalism affects families and how it ultimately can lead to a lot of harm.
It's interesting that you bring up, I don't know, because I feel like... I guess it's both now that you're saying it, because my mom would say that too, like, about friends and stuff. But it's also, like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of non-white, like, traditional, like, for example, like, Latinx families are more not nuclear, because it's not uncommon for, like, your abuelita to live with you or like I know, you know what I mean, or extended family members. Also, like, I don't know, maybe this is just a U.S. thing, but I know, like, when I go to Juarez, my family over there is always very, like, in just kind of community with everyone in, like, the neighbor, like, the, you know what I mean, like, around them. Like, just always, like, doing, like, go, you know, if someone needs to use their phone, like, there's this one neighbor who, like, has the phone and everyone gets to, like, use it, borrowing, like, just, like, very communal. And I don't know. Again, I don't know if it's because we're in the U.S., like in El Paso, even right across the border. Like, that's not a thing that I would see here a lot. But in Juarez, I would see it a lot. And also, I actually lived in Juarez, like, for the first 4 years of my life. And me and, like, our family, like, me and my siblings and my dad and my mom lived with, like, the whole family. Like, there was, like, 20 of us in, like, one house. It wasn't a little house, okay? It was, like, like, you know, there was space, and every, like, family had their own room, but it was, like, a community. Like, I don't know. So, again, I don't know if that's because we're in the U.S., but that was, like, more common. I feel like I would see it a lot in Juarez, or, like, in the rancho that my mom's from. But, anyway, what I'm saying is, like, I do feel that the nuclear family is kind of white. But again, I would like to just indulge now into, like, the history of it. And, like, I know, someone that y'all should be following, Thought Scholar, did a thread on their knowledge on the nuclear family and its history. And I was looking at that, and it, like, also, like, wanted, you know, it, I was like, oh, that's very interesting. I would actually like to read about that as well. But, you know, regardless of its history, I know it's important, but it's just, like, at the end of the day, it's isolating a lot of people, and it's leaving a lot of parents and a lot of children just out to, like, fend for themselves, right? Nuclear family structures can also be very colonial, which is something I also have seen Indigenous people talk about as well. Also because a lot of Indigenous communities were all about community, right? They're like, that wasn't a thing in Indigenous communities back then. But again, yeah, that's just a rant about the nuclear family. And
yeah, and with that, we'll go on break.
Planned Parenthood asked me to tell someone how I see them. So Cassandra, I want you to know I see you as someone who's really committed to learning and to growth. So I see the way you care, and I'm so lucky to see you and have you in my life.
Thank you. I don't know what to say.
Yeah. Aww. We'll say no more, but know that Planned Parenthood has got your back. And if you too want to be seen, visit www.beseen.org to learn more. That's www.beseen.org. All right. And we're going to go back to the show now. So you're bringing up a lot of stuff, like, that you were reading and that you were engaging. Like, what is one thing that really impacted you that you would be like, okay, this really kind of launched my thoughts into, you know, parenthood, or, you know, capitalism and the family? It doesn't necessarily have to be that, but it could, since we're on the topic.
Yeah, I've, I don't know. I think, like, my, I don't know if I would call it politics, or it's just, like, my understanding, or, like, my thoughts on, like, parenting, and have, like, grown so much, I think, within the last year, and, like, are, like, keep growing. And it's, like, I think at first, I would have never, like, obviously I know that I, my own personal experience and struggles with being a single mom under capitalism, right? Like, but, like, being able to, like, tie them specifically together, like, how capitalism actually hurts children, how the nuclear families are shit. A year ago, I probably would have never thought about it in this way. But I have been reading, you know, just, like, different, 'cause I've read, like, parenting books, and it's just, like, parenting from a place of, again, nonviolence, parenting from a place of, like, gentle parenting, conscious parenting, whatever like the parenting circles are calling it. But then actually reading work from like anarchists and like how parenting within an anarchist framework and then combining those two, I feel like that's kind of like what I'm trying to do or like have been doing. And so yeah, I think again, like I think a year ago I wouldn't have even thought like how does my, like being an anarchist or like these things like go hand in hand with, you know, like children's oppression and like liberation. And I just wanted to recommend there's a anthology, and you don't have to buy the book. I buy the book because I like books, but you can actually just Google No Against Adult Supremacy, and there's like this, it's like, you know, anarchists love fucking zines, and so it's like you can just access all of these essays from like different people on things like youth rights. There's an like anarchism and youth liberation. There's an article, an essay, I would say, by Carlos Morales called Abolish CPS. Like, just a lot of things centered against around children's rights and what is adult supremacy, what is adultism, what is, like, children's oppression, like, how are you contributing to that? Like, just so much that has been written about it coming from, like, an anarchist, you know, framework. And so even if you're not an anarchist, but just like someone, just anyone really, you should care about children and you should include them and center them and into like your thoughts and stuff. I would recommend starting there. It might be like a little, you might be like, what the fuck? Because I think a lot of these things for some people are just like, this is a lot. Like, why should we, you know, I don't know, like it. Centering children or including children, I think, for a lot of people is a lot. And then taking it a step further to say, like, why school is kind of like this prison-like place for children to go is, like, you know, thought-provoking. But it's, you know, you should engage it. So I recommend that.
Yeah, and it's not wrong. Like, I think one thing I forgot that I wanted to bring up is, like, you mentioned the foster care to prison pipeline, mm-hmm. right? And I always think about, you know, how it relates to the school to prison pipeline. Like, it gets kids used to, you know, obeying commands without mm-hmm. questioning, right? And it gets kids used to, for example, I went to a school that had 6,000 students, and all of our classes were about, at any given point, anywhere from 40 something kids to 60 something kids in a small classroom that was not built for that many kids. So it gets used to overcrowding. You know, our classes, our schools had these giant spiky gates and were constantly being patrolled by police. So it gets you used to police presence, right? And when that's the kind of norm that you were accustomed to, then a prison doesn't become such a big jump, right? So yeah, I can totally see how someone would directly call it a prison. And also, like, with reading radical articles, it isn't always about like, yeah, I'm gonna do this thing like word mm-hmm. for word. It's also about like, how does this realistically fit into my life, or what lesson can I take from this, right? Like, I think about how I always recommend The Revolution Starts at Home, and some of the essays in it, you know, advocate for straight up violence, and how I can understand where they're coming from, right? You know, I can understand why a victim would want to harm their abuser, right? It isn't necessarily the stance that I take, but I can see where they are, right? What's one essay from this collection that you would really, that really made you think and that you would kind of challenge folks to read?
I think for me, I was reading, there's one called Youth Rights by Kathleen Nicole O'Neill. And it made me think because I, you know, I'm a parent and I'm like, I'm kind of, I would say I don't know. Now I feel weird calling myself like a children's right advocate, but you know, I talk a lot about like children's rights and like not hitting children and seeing children as human, like, you know, these things. And it's like how just because you're a parent, like, you are, I think all adults are oppressive towards children, right? And so, like, I kind of knew that, but I think taking it a step further, like, as a parent, even I'm even more so, because I'm in a direct connection to my child and I have more power over them as their parent. And so, like, what does that mean? And what does it mean as someone who, you know, is, like, talking about children's rights and is trying to educate other people, and how to not take up space at the same time? Because I'm, like, saying, you know, children have their own thoughts and they're smart and they can do this. And it's like, okay, when do I let them do that then, right? Like, and let them speak for themselves. And also, like, yeah, I think that kind of just made me think about how, as a parent, obviously I know that there's this power dynamic, obviously, between me and my child. Like, I knew that, but I think taking it a step further as, like, as someone who talks about children's rights, like, we kind of need to let children and teens also have, like, their own saying without also, how do I explain it? Like, without me saying, like, oh, I know what's good for you, right? Which is something I think a lot of quote-unquote allies do, right? Like, right, I'm not calling myself an ally to my child, but it was just very thought-provoking. So for parents, I would recommend that one, I guess.
And what was the name of the book again?
No Against Adult Supremacy.
I've read quite a bit, but recently, one of the most, I think, poignant things I read, like, maybe like a couple of days ago, was actually this essay titled The Curse Privilege of the Tender Queer by Dolly Rose. And, you know, they are a Black disabled queer person, and they were talking about how there's this way that sometimes people in queer communities weaponize the language of social justice to kind of, like, not take accountability for just being shitty friends, right? And so, you know, they'll use things like, oh, like, I don't want to solve this conflict because, you know, this is really, any little disagreement is triggering, right? Where conflict is, like, a regular part of human relationships, right? And it essentially talks about how being a tender queer, I don't know if you're familiar with the term, but it's, like, something that, like, it's big in California, especially, like, in the Bay Area, where, you know, you just want to tend to your succulents and, like, you know, live your little bougie lifestyle and engage in community when it's beneficial, but not when you have to give back and, like, be there for people. And it talks about how only essentially people who are white and conventionally attractive and otherwise privileged are able to embody this tender queer, and a lot of other folks are not. So I've it's something that I felt resonate with me, especially as someone who left the Bay Area a couple years ago, and then before that left Davis. And it's just something that I encountered a lot. And it paired well with this book that I read, Alexander Chee's How to Write an Autobiography, wherein he essentially writes about being part of the AIDS rights movement, but also kind of obfuscates the fact that, like, he was raised, like, really, really rich. And to me, reading this essay right after finishing that book and really enjoying that book and seeing the kind of, you know, work that he did to advance, you know, he worked with ACT UP, for example, so, which was is one of the most important AIDS organizations of AIDS rights organizations ever. It really made me question some things about, like, you know, who has the time to sometimes engage in community work, and how class, you know, really keeps a lot of us from engaging in these struggles, right? But also class and not being, and being often ostracized from community due to desirability, politics, and other things also keep us from getting care. So it's like something I've been sitting with that I read that I thought was really interesting. Yeah. So both the curse of the curse privilege of the tender queer, and also Alexander Chee's How to Write an Autobiography.
Those sound really interesting. I need to put them on my list.
And with that said, we will close out the episode with the thing that made us less bitter.
I'm always ready for this. let's see. Well, I did go indoor skydiving like 2 weeks ago.
More.
3 weeks ago. I don't know at this point, which is something that had been on my bucket list for some time.
I can't believe that was
on anybody's was on mine list. Because the next one now is real skydiving. That was like the, you know, like the practice round. Yeah, it was fun. I'm really surprised that tour season has been kind of cool, because I hate Tauruses. I don't like Taurus energy in general, and it's kind of like really slow. But for some reason, I've been like on the move. I don't know why, but I've been like accomplishing a lot of things, which for me is like very... like little things. I actually, you know, I had like on my notes app, I'm like something simple, like that I'm just like, call and make this appointment, right? That's been sitting, like, I've whatever. I have done a lot. And I don't know where it, maybe, I don't know. But it's made me less bitter, I guess. Also, being able to see a doctor for like the first time in my adult life since I was pregnant, which I'm not gonna start ranting about healthcare, but the only reason I have healthcare right now, aka Medicaid, is because I don't have a fucking job, so I'm taking advantage, you know. But yeah, those things made me less bitter, and yeah, I think I've just been like proud of myself, because I've been like keeping up with these little goals of mine, even if it's just like something very, very simple that I've done. That also, I started taking medication for my anxiety and depression, so maybe it's that. I have no idea. yeah, that's made me less bitter, I guess.
So what has made me less bitter? Crap, I am always unready.
We both are. We're always like, I just want to like be angry. Just kidding.
Yeah, you know, what has made me less bitter? Oh, the new Pokemon Snap game. Yeah, I've found it really fun and engaging, and it's a good distraction, and it's like a very low stakes game and not super active. Like you can just look at the pretty landscape, because all you're supposed to do is take pictures of the Pokemon. So it's like you can just not, and you can just enjoy the atmosphere, and that's cute. So I like
it's like on your phone, right?
It's on the Switch.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like really high graphics. You just go through the Pokemon world and you watch them in their natural environment, and you take pictures, and then you get graded on them. That's cute.
That sounds cute.
Yeah. Yeah, it is basically just a cute game. So that's what's made me less bitter. Yeah.
Okay.
We're so funny. But yeah. All right, y'all. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Bitter Brown Fams. I hope y'all are doing well and keeping safe. And remember to follow us across all social media.
Remember to wear your masks. And, leave us reviews and stop attacking me on Twitter. I'm just kidding. You can continue. but stay safe, y'all. We'll see you soon. Bye.
All right, y'all. Take care.
Bye.
All right, before we head out, we have to give a shout out to all of our I Know Her Level patrons. Y'all are so real. Thank y'all so much for your support, especially Abigail and Aranya, Ames T, Alana F, Alejandra M, Ali T, Amy M, Bianca G, Brenda C, Clara P, Chrissy J, Daniel V, Erika A, Gianna R, Griselda M, Jen A, Jocelyn D, Justine, Karina C, Kimberly B, Layla G, Linda Marie, Lisbeth K, Magdalena S, Miguel B, Nancy M, Natasha B, Raul S, Ronnie L, Sara R, Sara M, Tate, Valentina R, Vanessa, Yasmin, and Yulitsa. Y'all are truly the best. Thank y'all so much.